Okay, let's see. Dole's up, and then Molly, and Sarah, and Tom, and Claire, and a whole bunch of people. So let's see. Dole, you got the microphone there. You're up, and then Molly, you'll be after that.
Was terrific. So it's, as you pointed out, it's not fair to ask a historian to speculate about the future.
But
so
you're going to do
I will I will cloak my question as a question about the 28 years now since Reagan's farewell speech. So the modern context. And I'm trying to, what I really want to ask you to do is connect what you've been talking about to some of the recent demographic, the writing based on demographics that, for example, Robert P. George did in The End of White Christian America, and that Robert George, it's hard to keep them apart, and Bob Putnam and David Campbell's demographic work. So here we go. The context of most of the history you're talking about was an America that was not just majority Christian, but majority white Protestant until, in Jones's figures, around 1993. We're still a country that, by the stats, is about 70% Christian, including all races and ethnic groups. But as you point out, the nuns are growing. So the large question is, how sustainable, how powerful, how adaptable is a national myth in a less Christian, less biblically literate nation? And then a slightly, and then a more granular question that I think really follows on I guess Elizabeth's question about exceptionalism. Is there an important distinction to be made between a religiously based version of the idea of American exceptionalism and what you might call the secular exceptionalism that would have been talked about by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton? Are they the same? Are they really the same argument?
Before you answer, could I ask, is somebody adjusting the temperature? It's gotten really cold in here. Isn't it cold? I mean, we don't want to get it so warm you go to sleep, but at the same time, we also do want you to start shivering. So we're looking into that.
Yeah. So on the first question about the end of white Christian America, we're not there yet. I do feel as if Christianity was so deeply woven into the fabric of the nation as it was created that there are certain kinds of ideas that people don't even realize have Christian roots. So I do feel as if Christianity is still a very important influence on American culture, even if it's invisible. I co-edited a book called American Christianities, A History of Dominance and Diversity with a former colleague at University of Chicago, W. Clark Gilpin. And he had a wonderful image of the way that Christianity is, it's like a lightning bolt. It's definitely there. It sort of flashes and you see it, but then it's gone. But I do think that there are a lot of Christian understandings that are really a part of the way that we think about our lives. So there's a psychologist at Northwestern, Dan McAdams, who's written a book called The Redemptive Self. And when you read that book, it seems like when people have told the stories of their lives, whether they realize it or not, they have put it in a Christian framework around redemption. So I think they're kind of scripts that are still there. How sustainable is this understanding of America as a chosen nation? I think it is in the process of being transformed into an understanding of American exceptionalism. And I'll be honest here, I'm speaking, you know, not as a scholar, but I guess as an American. American exceptionalism worries me because I do feel as if even if people have used the language of chosen nation in ways that are exploitative, there is a religious check on some of that. That, you know, if people are serious about Christianity, that there are understandings of humility and sacrifice that go with that language. I think when you start talking about American exceptionalism, that part drops out completely, and it all that you get is an understanding that America is somehow unique and special. Reinhold Niebuhr, the great theologian who was alive during World War II, argued at that moment that America was chosen, but he argued that America wasn't chosen for all time and for all history, but rather at that particular moment, God had a task for America to do. And so he wanted to distinguish between America as a chosen nation versus the chosen nation. It seems to me that American exceptionalism gets rid of some of that humility, or at least it could. It's a language that worries me. I'm not sure that when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton used the language that it was entirely secular. I think it's possible that it's coming out of their religious visions as well. I heard some of that, especially in Obama's language of the common good. Whether this language can really be maintained in a nation that's becoming less identified with at least institutional Christianity is definitely a question. But if this idea is going to survive in any form, I would rather have it survive in a Christian form than in a purely secular one.
Okay, Molly, pull the microphone up and turn the green light on. And then Sarah.
I have two totally unrelated questions.
I'm sorry.
It's not my turn. Okay.
Yeah, Molly Ball. It's Molly Ball. And I wrote down Molly Hemingway. And It's Molly Ball, and then it's Molly Hemingway. Molly Ball right here. You're up. Sorry.
So you talk about this remarkable very early moment when the colonists go from distrusting democracy to rather awkwardly using the Bible to justify democracy. How and why does that shift happen? And then second question, what's been the relationship of this strain of thinking to Judaism? It seems like, you know, you go from the Klan, obviously no friend to the Jews, to today you often hear politicians couching this as a Judeo-Christian nation, mm-hmm. and explicitly bringing the Jews into the fold and obviously invoking Israel.
Mm-hmm. So let me answer the second question first. And somewhere I do have some, here's a piece of sheet music. That's really a kind of celebration of American Jews, of the opportunities in America. So this understanding of America as a chosen nation has Protestant roots, but both Catholics and Jews adopt this as their own in the 19th century during their immigrant experiences. For Catholics, we have the so-called Americanist controversy where there are American priests and bishops who've gotten into trouble with Rome because they say that the church had become more American. And for Judaism in particular, Jews tend to see America as exceptional because they're not persecuted in the way that they were in Russia or in Germany. So Reform Jews in particular begin describing the United States as the promised land in the late 19th century. So this is before 1917. This is before Zionism seems like it could become a reality, you know, that there might be a homeland for Jews. But Reform Jews in America in the late 19th century said, we are no longer in a diaspora. This is our promised land. So they really helped to propagate this idea. I guess, you know, it's sort of ironic having this conversation that some of the roots of the idea that the Bible sanctioned democracy actually come from rabbinic texts that were being studied by Protestant scholars in the wake of the Protestant Reformation. And there were prominent Jewish rabbis who were trying to argue against monarchy using the Bible. And this kind of commentary was rediscovered by Protestant theologians in the 1600s. And they began to build the case for a republican system of government. In some ways, the question about, you know, How or why did Puritans want to rewrite the Bible this way is really a story about what caused the American Revolution. And again, you know, there have been political interpretations of this, economic interpretations. There certainly is a religious dimension. But it's clear that in the 1700s, there were a number of Protestant ministers in particular who were using this a sort of radical Reformation understanding of a republican system of government to argue for democracy, but it takes time, and you know those strands are kind of in some ways you can imagine it is that these are various strands that get put together by ministers who start thinking more systematically about does the Bible provide any kind of guidance for a system of government that's not a monarchy.
Sarah Bailey, over here. Is the green light on?
Sorry, kind of connected to this. I was curious whether the language of this American exceptionalism, city on a hill, shifted when the modern nation of Israel was formed. Was there any backing away of that language applied to the U.S. once Israel was formed? You know, how can there be two chosen nations? Mm-hmm. From conservative Christians, specifically.
From conservative Christians. There certainly is a change for Jews. Even Reform Jews tone down their language about America, and they're very interested in raising money for Israel. For conservative Christians, this is... it depends on which Christians we're talking about. So some of you may know something about fundamentalists who are premillennial dispensationalists who read the Bible in a particular way in which there are different dispensations of history and there will literally be a rapture at the end of time. This is the hallmark of premillennial dispensationalism. Those fundamentalist Christians argue from their reading of the prophetic books of the Bible that Jesus is literally going to come back as a king, and he will be the literal king of Israel. And so the apocalypse, the key events are going to happen in Israel for them. But for other Christians who are not reading the Bible through this premillennial dispensationalist lens, America is still very important as a place that's chosen. One group that I haven't spoken about at all that I will definitely need to write about in my book are the Mormons, who believe that Jesus, after his resurrection, came to America. And so in their theology, America really is sacred land because Jesus appeared there. And so, you know, they're expecting America to be the center of the the most crucial part of the revelation.
Molly Hemingway, and then Tom, you're after Molly. Be sure the green light is on, Molly.
Yes. So This has mostly been covered by Elizabeth, Miranda, and Doyle's questions, but I'm still trying to understand the current state of exceptionalism rhetoric and thought. And you did a really great job of showing us how, almost from the very beginning, there were people who spoke in religious terms, perhaps understanding the exceptionalism as based in the religious liberty that they had, as opposed to where they came from, or more secularists who didn't fight that language but found the exceptionalism based in self-government and the uniqueness of the American project. And you can see those carry through to the present moment, but I'm still trying to figure out how they're understood now on left and right. So you mentioned Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton had spoken about American exceptionalism, and you definitely hear that. I also remember something like President Obama saying, of course, America is exceptional in the same way France views itself as exceptional and other countries view themselves as exceptional. So I'm kind of just wondering, like, what's the basis for describing America as unique from other nations, unless it's just that, like every country for itself.
Yeah.
And then on the right, it seems like there is this change into a nationalist approach, and so you see on the right becoming like America First Party, sort of. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious how that is different in this conversation on exceptionalism from the other nationalist movements you're seeing in Europe, or if they're part and parcel of this.
Yeah, so I was talking to someone in the break about Europe, and I feel as if I can't answer that question because I would have to do a lot more research. I mean, it would be very interesting to compare the sort of language that's being used here to there, and to think about common religious roots, coming out of the Radical Reformation. I'm sure that some of that is there, but I don't know the context well enough. So I was hoping that journalists would help me with a contemporary moment. I think that...
Well, they will. Don't worry.
So I'm eager to hear where all of you are hearing it in your interviews and when you're out and about. So Obama did say... At one point, Obama sounded as if he was rejecting American exceptionalism, and then it sounded as if he was embracing it more. In some ways, you'd want to get him into this room and say, what is it that you really think, and how would you define this, and how religious is this for you? I think for people today... the idea of American chosenness is wrapped up not only with a kind of religious identity, but with capitalism, with technological success, with democracy, definitely. It's I think this is a highly political understanding. I think where Donald Trump differs from Obama, and maybe where we see some of Obama's exceptionalism, Obama clearly felt as if America had a kind of responsibility to the rest of the world, and that democracy was a kind of gift given to the American people that needed to be spread around the world. And I don't hear Trump saying that at all. For Trump, what he cares about is what's at home. And not what's abroad. For somebody like Clinton or someone like Obama, I don't feel as if I could really say what their religious investment in this is, but it's clear that they have a very strong political investment in thinking that democracy is, in fact, the last best hope, to go back to Thomas Jefferson. I think you could trace that sort of Jeffersonian idea through various political figures. And for him, it was really about the importance of democracy as a political system. I want to distinguish in some ways between the left and the right, because it seems to me that they have different understandings of what this means. And I think for people on the left, there's more of an emphasis on if America is chosen, then there should be a concern for the common good. Whereas I think for some of the people on the right, the fact that America is chosen means that individuals have the opportunity to express themselves here. So I think there are these kinds of differences, but I'm really struck by the fact that they're arguing over the same concept or the same language.
I mean, you're asking about the current context of it, Molly. Isn't the current context that, at least for the first time I can think of, American exceptionalism got weaponized and used against, you know, this stumble on Obama's part then becomes a talking point of every single Republican candidate in the 2012 cycle. And that was, and, you know, a lot of people saw in it this undercurrent of he's the other. You know, he's somehow not fully American. And that's, I mean, that is where, in the political context, I think it's different now than it had been before. I mean, is there...
So what you mean by that is that people are much more self-conscious about using it and that there are arguments about who's using this language and why, whereas in previous generations, it was there, but it wasn't really at the surface. Yeah, that is, I think that's absolutely true, and it's really very interesting, because I think some of your questions about, you know, how expedient are people when they use this is coming partially out of our contemporary environment where people are very self-conscious about how they're using this language, and Obama was told that he should be using this language, so it wasn't sort of coming naturally. And that suggests that we probably are, you know, in sight of some real changes here because this is no longer a sort of taken for granted concept, but a political football.
Okay, Tom, you're up, and then Claire and Emma and David and Michelle and everybody.
You mentioned that Trump had great support with conservative Christians who ignore his words and compared him to David, who committed adultery. In my blue liberal Oregon, that would be seen as another ignorant Christian. And I'm struck by the historical perspective and intellectualism here, which is a bubble, compared to the real world where people say, I believe what I want to believe. And I wonder what you think about this lack of common language to speak about Christianity and history and education, and what problem does that present, and what's the solution?
Yeah. So you think people in Oregon would say that saying that, that Trump is like the biblical David is a sort of ignorant thing to do?
People would, there would not be discussion. People would say, you got to be kidding me. Mm-hmm. And people would say, well, that's what I believe, and they'd quote a Bible passage. And this divide starts, nope, I can't think of any discussion I've had in the last 10 years that's like today here, mm-hmm. historical. Mm-hmm. And people become in opposition to each other. There's no common discussion. And I wonder in our schools and our communities, how do we have these kind of conversations where someone can explain what they mean? If somebody says getting a pass because he's David, like David, they'd say, that's like a get-out-of-jail-free card. It makes no sense. So I wonder what problem does that present, mm-hmm. and how do we solve it?
Yeah. Clearly this is a problem. I would recommend that people go look at the Religious Literacy Project at Harvard Divinity School. So some of you were at a conference at Harvard Divinity School in December. I know Adele was. Run by my colleague Diane Moore, who has really made it her mission to try to create the conversation that you want to have happen. That she wants to provide the tools to educate people about religion and to create a context where people can speak in a way that isn't immediately polarizing. And I don't think there are that many opportunities to do that. I do think that... you know, the people, so I do not think that, personally, I don't think that Donald Trump and the biblical David have a lot in common. But when you speak to someone like that, they actually have done their biblical reading. And now there are other issues, I think, around David that they ignore. But I think it's really important to be able to listen to them and to take them seriously without immediately saying, you know, this is you just trying to make an excuse for a vote that you shouldn't have cast. Because I do think that there are a lot of people who are still seeing the world in these religious categories in a very serious way. So I think we have a lot more work to do. I think I'm so glad that all of you are here, because I think it means that, you know, there are journalists who really do want to understand people's religious motivations and people's religiosity in more depth, instead of just reducing people's religiosity to some sort of political or self-interest, which I think is what tends to happen.
Claire Duffy, and then Emma.
I just had two questions, and I don't know. I was fascinated by the discussion about Phyllis Wheatley and Mariah Stewart, two people whose work I was unfamiliar with. And I was... It is on, yeah. No, it is. Sorry, am I not like... Okay, there we go. That's comfortable. Yeah. And I wanted to know how their work was viewed at the time. Was it seen as, well, this is, you know, this is interesting, an interesting voice based on gender and race, but what about the ideas? Was voicing, I guess, for lack of a better word, skepticism in, you know, the America's chosenness, was that seen as, was it shouted down in the public sphere? Was there such unanimity of thought that was just kind of dismissed out of hand? How vigorous was this debate? And I guess if I had a better reading of history at that time, I would know the answer. And my other question is a little more contemporary, based on what Molly Ziegler was talking about with America First. Could America First be seen as almost a rejection of John Winthrop's burden? Are we tired of being? Is there something about that? It's like, you know what? We're not going to. We can't worry about being an example to the world anymore. This has become a burden, as he said it would. And is it sort of walking back from that? I'm curious. I know those are two unrelated things. And,
yeah. Great questions. Mm-hmm. So on the first one, here's Phyllis Wheatley again. I think she was seen as a curiosity. A lot of people wrote about her because they were just astonished that an African-American woman could be this intelligent. So I actually think that, you know, the publication of this book was so important, just as a kind of symbol of Black women's intelligence and their gifts. But I would say that this text was very threatening to some people. So Thomas Jefferson writes about it in Notes on the State of Virginia, and just very briefly, where he says, Phyllis Wheatley's poetry is below the dignity of criticism. I would recommend you go and read her poetry. She was actually sort of out of fashion, I think, in the 1970s and 1980s, when African American studies was sort of growing. She was almost sort of too classical. She seemed too, quote unquote, white almost, because she's so well versed in the Bible and in classical literature. But it's because she's so intelligent that she seems threatening and needs to be dismissed. You know, Jefferson is so cutting and just says, we can't even talk about this. There are a few examples that we have from the archives of slaves trying to make this argument that white colonists were actually Pharaoh. They were seen as being very dangerous. So I wish I could remember where this happened. I could look it up, but there was a slave, we only know his first name, David, who gave a lay sermon, and some whites overheard it. And he made this comparison of colonists to Egyptians, and he almost was lynched. There was a white man who bought him to save him and then sent him out of the colonies. I think he was sold into the West Indies because this was such a dangerous thing for a black person to say. The late 18th century is the beginning of the abolitionist movement or anti-slavery movement, which is a story in and of itself. All of a sudden, you know, in the 1770s, you have the first significant mass movement opposing slavery. And there were ministers, for example, a minister named Samuel Hopkins, who was in Newport, Rhode Island, who made this comparison also, and who pointed out the hypocrisy of colonial Americans demanding their freedom from England and describing themselves as slaves, which they often did. They said they were enslaved by the British at the time that they themselves were holding slaves. So this language exists, but it was radical language that most Americans resisted at the time. On the other question about America First and are we saying that John Winthrop's burden is just too heavy to bear, there's an old book about ideas of America as a Redeemer Nation by Ernest Tufson called Redeemer Nation, in which he argues that the idea of American chosenness has come basically in two flavors. America as Eden, and America as the place that needs to be protected from the serpent, and that is kind of an enclosed garden, a sort of paradise. And America as the new Israel that is expanding outward. So I think that these internal impulses have always been there, but I do hear the language that you're describing, that I do feel as if there are many Americans who say, I'm tired of sending troops overseas. I'm tired of feeling as if America is the world's police officer who's supposed to fix everything else. So they're really focused on America, still I think being chosen, but looking inward and only focusing on one another rather than the rest of the world.
Emma Green, if you'll pull the microphone up and
turn it on. All right. I've been curious in listening to your narrative of domestic religious nationalism, how that affects attitudes towards our role overseas. Mm-hmm. And I've been particularly curious about this in the current context, contrasting George W. Bush and Trump, the way that they use rhetoric about intervention abroad, our obligation to defend human rights overseas. I think we're probably too early into the Trump presidency to discern any distinctive or at least consistent narrative or outlook or philosophy. I think that's still in evolution and understandably so. But I'm curious about the way that this vision of American exceptionalism can have radically different outcomes and orientations when it comes to foreign policy and particularly mm-hmm. intervening on behalf of people who are besieged overseas.
Yeah. I think since World War II in particular, this sort of language has gone along with the idea that the United States, as a chosen nation, is supposed to have a major influence on the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. I think it's very interesting, though. I mean, this has been somewhat contested. There's in John F. Kennedy's inaugural speech, he referred to the United Nations as being chosen. That the United Nations was supposed to be the sort of beacon to the rest of the world. By the time you get to Reagan, it's no longer United Nations. It's just the United States on its own. But even going back into the 19th century, I mentioned Albert Beveridge, the senator from Indiana, who used this kind of idea of American chosenness to justify intervention in the Philippines, in Cuba. I think this language has always had the potential to be used in sort of imperialist ways. Mm-hmm. It also has had the potential to be used in humanitarian ways. Mm-hmm. And of course, these things are not always opposed. Mm-hmm. Sometimes these things go hand in hand. I think that this language is really crucial to understanding foreign policy, understanding people's motivations. I think this was especially true for George W. Bush, who, you know, did not intend at the beginning of his presidency to be involved globally, but I think he felt as if his faith really called him to it.
So just to follow up and clarify, yeah. So are there antecedents that come to mind to think about the opposite outcome, which is the conclusion that America should be less involved overseas, that our first obligation is to our citizens here, and that sort of an interventionist policy is wrongheaded and does not fit with the notion of American exceptionalism?
Certainly Woodrow Wilson falls into this category where Wilson was very reluctant to become involved in World War I. He used a lot of this kind of language of American exceptionalism. So he was trying to sort of hold things back, but eventually decided that America was called, to take a global role. There are also a number of very interesting cases of missionaries who have been working abroad, who, you know, in some ways, missionaries, I think, get a bad rap. They're seen as sort of the agents of imperialism, but often missionaries on the ground are arguing that Americans should not be involved in the foreign policy of these countries, or that, you know, the good of the people suggests humanitarian aid, but not military intervention.
It's too bad our friend and colleague Michael Gerson, who usually attends these, is at another meeting in Dallas and couldn't be here, because it seems to me that a lot of what you've been saying is a lot of speechwriters for presidents need to know this topic, because we keep citing Obama and Hillary and George W. and Ronald Reagan, and clearly the speechwriters know this language and have to tell their president, we need to use this language. Or you're using it too much, or you're not using it enough. I would love to have Michael here to comment on the discussions they would have had about that. Let's see. It would be great. Yes, indeed. David Rennie, you're up, and then Michelle Cottle and Sally and AB and EJ and Jordana and everyone. But David Rennie, pull the mic up, please.
Thank you for the great questions, by the way.
I'm about to spoil that.
Maybe not.
Can I ask you a historical question about expertise? So it seems to me that you can, if you're trying to kind of parse out why the right has for some years kind of owned the idea of sort of inerrant truths in either the Bible or in the Constitution, that whole kind of Tea Party idea of there are a set of kind of founding principles, and if we, you know, when you talked about originalism and how that blurs across with the idea of suspicion of, you know, progressive arguments that these things are living texts. At what point in American history did that kind of suspicion, that Protestant idea of the kind of the plain man sitting on the porch reading the Bible, kind of extracting sort of imminent truths from it? And then I think you can see that with the Tea Party's kind of reverence for the Constitution. That's a very similar kind of psychological experience there. And you can see why, to get to EJ's point about opportunism, it's very useful for a reactionary political movement to then bind that up with suspicion of elites and suspicion of expertise, and particularly elites and experts who are seen as kind of progressives. If you buy any of that kind of theory of mine, tell us about the history of that. Did that pop up quite early?
Yeah. So you're interested in a sort of plain common sense reading of the Bible and its political implications. So you see this immediately after the American Revolution. The Revolution, I think, really acted as a kind of solvent that dissolved a lot of understandings about tradition and hierarchy. So there are a series of revivals that historians call the Second Great Awakening that begin really immediately after the Revolution, as early as the 1790s on the frontier, stretching into the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, where in the atmosphere of new religious freedom created by the First Amendment and created by disestablishment, new Protestant sects begin popping up. So remember that before the American Revolution, most of the colonies had established churches. And that meant that whether or not you attended the church, you had to pay taxes to support the church. After the First Amendment and after states disestablished their churches, because the First Amendment was originally not binding on states, just the national government, as that happened, you get all this competition. It's a kind of free market of religion in the early 1800s. The Methodists, which had been founded in England and had started to make a few inroads before the American Revolution, really explode. There are new groups that probably you would not have heard of before, the Christian Connection, the Free Will Baptists, who become very, very popular and who are competing with the old established churches, the Congregationalists and the Anglicans. And in these new religious movements, you have, I think, a very strong anti-hierarchical tendency. And you have people preaching who have never been to college. And those religious groups are proud of that. They say the Holy Spirit can inspire anyone to preach. And so here we have a farmer who was directly inspired by the Holy Spirit, who's reading the Bible for himself and using his common sense. And this comes from the Enlightenment, partially. He's using his common sense, and he's seeing things in the Bible that were obscured by sort of more complicated allegorical or metaphorical readings. So you have some really fascinating, I would call religious populists in the early 19th century, who are reading the Bible literally and coming up with new meanings. So there's a wonderful character named Lorenzo Dow, who had never gone to college. He apparently was a very powerful preacher, very theatrical, would go from camp meeting to camp meeting, attracting thousands of people, and arguing on behalf of not only democracy, but Christianity. So he's trying to spread the gospel, but he definitely saw the nation as specially chosen. So I think that this kind of language has very deep roots in American culture that go all the way to the post-revolutionary period. And that language has always been entangled with populist movements. What tends to happen is that, let me just take the Methodists as an example. The Methodists were really seen as sort of countercultural in the late 18th century. Most of their ministers were not well educated. They had not started building seminaries. As they began to grow, they started building schools, building seminaries. Their ministers become educated, and they become somewhat embarrassed by their history. And as they become more respectable, they're then a group within the Methodists who think they become too respectable, and they become holiness preachers and start the cycle again. And then when holiness becomes too respectable, out of holiness comes the Pentecostal movement. And we could keep going. So I think this is a powerful dynamic that has very old roots. And, you know, the idea that you could just open the Bible and read it like a novel and be able to understand it just with a kind of grade school education is a very old one in the United States. It's very appealing in some ways because, you know, it is very democratic. I think you can also, though, trace that kind of biblical reading to some of the tragedies in American history, including slavery. Where, you know, if you read the Hebrew Bible literally, you can come up with a pretty good defense of slavery. And pro-slavery theologians in the 1830s did exactly that. And the people arguing against slavery had to talk about the spirit of the Bible and the fact that Jesus never explicitly sanctioned slavery. and that the Sermon on the Mount was meant to abolish slavery, even though slavery was never explicitly mentioned. So I hope that answers your question just about the roots of this kind of language.
The best book on this, you would agree, is Nathan Hatch's book, The Democratization of American Christianity, which covers everything you just said and much more.
Right.
In fact, it's even in there that the preacher Lorenzo Dow, didn't he show up at the White House with like a 2,000-pound thing of cheese?
No, that was not Lorenzo Dow. I'm trying to remember who that was.
It's in Hatch's book, and
yeah.
It's very odd. He was protesting something, and he brought like a 1,000-pound thing of cheese to make a point.
And I'll think he's a Southern minister. I'll think of who it is.
I thought it was Dow. Anyway,
it wasn't Dow. It was someone else. But
The book is Nathan Hatch is an American religious historian, now president of Wake Forest University. But he wrote this book, The Democratization of American Christianity. It won all these awards, history prizes, and so I call that to your attention and reference. We like to promote books here.
Yeah.
Michelle Cottle, you're up next, and then Sally.
So kind of referring back to Doyle's line of questioning in terms of how sustainable is this idea in a different kind of religious America, I mean, you mentioned that the right does a much better job of employing this language politically, domestically. To what degree do you think that kind of boils down to the, even if not the specific leaders like Obama or Hillary Clinton, the left itself is a much more secular group, and so you can't point to the God and country strain that you have that runs deep in right-wing grassroots politics. So you are having to look for another way to make it resonate mm-hmm. on some level.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's absolutely a true observation. Something that I will be wrestling with in this book that I have only begun to wrestle with is looking at the way that feminists in the 1970s try to use this language or fail to use this language. So you can definitely find this understanding of American chosenness in the work of somebody like Frances Willard, who was in the Women's Christian Temperance Union. The WCTU was a major factor in the passage of women's suffrage. And it seemed to me that those early women's rights activists, the mainstream ones, not Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who is very anti-Christian, but the Frances Willards and the other women of the WCTU, I think used this kind of understanding of American chosenness to sanction women's rights. I think they did that very successfully. I think civil rights activists in the 1950s and 1960s also used this very successfully because there was a long tradition in black churches of thinking about how to make the United States more racially egalitarian in a Christian way. I think women's rights activists in the 1970s were really split about religion. If you read the founding statement of NOW, it really reads kind of flat. It's like a programmatic kind of, you know, this is what we want, you know, versus reading some of the civil rights pamphlets, which I think did a wonderful job of putting civil rights in a kind of transcendent context, that this is, you know, this is more than just we want better jobs, you know, this is about God's will. And I think that, the reason I'm bringing this up in response to your question is I think that the religious divisiveness in second wave feminism made it very difficult for them to claim that language as their own and use it as successfully, I think, as civil rights activists did.
Sally?
Well, I just wanted to, I'm interested in what Karen had said about the evolution between the Winthrop communalism idea and de Tocqueville's individualism and the evolution of religion / politics in this country, starting with the idea of the Puritans and then going to the deists. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty big leap from Puritanism to deism to Thomas Jefferson's Bible. And then moving on to the evangelicals, which is pretty far removed from the deist. I was interested in what you were saying about the teachers teaching, you know, the homeschoolers teaching the children, that the deist actually had put in that, you know, in the Constitution that the Bible was important to read. But here we are today, and what we've got is we've got evangelicalism, and as you, I think, rightly point out, a lot of the evangelicals aren't really evangelical. In fact, a lot of them aren't even serious Christians. We have probably 25% of people in this country, if not more, are nuns. Mm-hmm. Atheism and agnosticism are much more accepted today than they ever were before. And certainly the evangelical vote for Donald Trump, his campaign, I think, was probably the antithesis of Christian behavior. And so I wonder where you think we're going. We started out very Puritan. We're at a stage now where even the really religious people aren't that religious, and so many other people are taking sort of different paths. Do you think that it's possible that we would end up with an atheist president?
No.
And why not? I mean, I'm really curious to know, because we're in the stage now where it seems that religion, people have to mouth that you can't get elected now being an atheist. And even Obama, you know, sort of got religion at some point. And when he did his Sojourner's speech, it was really one of the first major speeches a president gave about religion, where he talked about believers and non-believers. So he sort of introduced that idea 9 years or 10 years ago. But so where are we going? Mm-hmm. How do you get from being a Puritan to a deist and then to this sort of hodgepodge of a lot, I hate to use the word hypocritical religion, mm-hmm. and people sort of saying, I don't buy it, you know, I'm spiritual, but I'm, you know, I don't buy this traditional religion.
Yeah. So a couple things. I would say first that I would be careful about suggesting that a sort of Puritan communal vision has completely disappeared. I think it's still there. I think there are sort of poles. You know, there's a sort of individualistic religion, but there certainly is also a religion that focuses more on the common good. I think when Pope Francis came to visit, that was really electrifying because that was the kind of language that he was using. So I don't think that American religion has become purely individualistic. I think it's a mixture of things. I do think there's a very strong strain of individualism within Protestant conservatism, but I don't think that that's the only story. And I would also be careful. So, you know, I made this point earlier that there have been polls in which there are people identifying themselves as evangelicals who, you know, I don't think they're really evangelicals. I think they think of it as a political category. But I would not say that all evangelicals are hypocrites, or I think that there are people with genuinely held beliefs.
I didn't mean to imply
beliefs.
That, but I mean, I was picking up from what you said, and which it seems pretty obvious that in the polls that show that so many of these people who claim to be evangelicals don't go to church.
Right. But I think there are evangelicals who do go to church and who are very serious about this. So I think we're at a moment where American religion is really in flux. I mean, this is partly generational. I see this among my students at Harvard Divinity School. I have to say that before teaching at Harvard, I was rather skeptical about this whole idea of spiritual but not religious, which I thought was just an empty category. But I am meeting people who seem really very sincere in terms of their, you know, desire for spiritual understanding, at the same time that they're just very suspicious of institutional religion. And I think that phrase, spiritual but not religious, is really reflecting the collapse of faith, I think more broadly in American institutions, but also in American churches and synagogues. And so there's a generation, and also, you know, people my age, who see religion as personally fulfilling but don't trust any institution. And so they've really been sort of cut adrift. It's really hard for me to imagine someone being elected who was an atheist for a number of reasons. As a historian, I know that even after disestablishment, even after the First Amendment, which did not apply to the states originally, there were states that had rules on the books, laws on the books that said that you could not be a governor or an elected official unless you believed in a future state of reward and punishment, which I think is fascinating. So
that's still on the books?
I'm sure it still is, but it's not, you know, it's not invoked anymore. I don't know if all of these laws have been repealed, although I think I remember now there was some story about some place where that hadn't been actually repealed, and someone was trying to make a claim that whoever had been elected did not believe in a future state of reward or punishment. So I think that even, you know, even for the founders who were deists, that they did see that religion was important sociologically as a source of morality. And I think there was a lot of anxiety that if you elected someone to be a leader who didn't believe that they were going to be held accountable in the next life, that there would be no restraint on them. And I think that kind of idea is still sort of floating around in American culture, even if people don't want or don't care, you know, exactly specifically what someone is. They want a sense that the leader has a moral compass.
So how do you explain Trump?
Well, I think that there were religious conservatives who did a lot of work trying to suggest that he did and does, in fact, have a moral compass. I mean, personally, I don't find that believable, but I think people did find that believable, and I think that there were ministers who did a lot of work, you know, saying, okay, let's look at people who are chosen in the Bible. And it's true, the Bible is full of sinful people who are chosen by God to do great things. And that is the way that they tried to package Trump, and apparently it was successful. I was very surprised. I did not think it would be successful. There's a whole other story here, which I think, you know, I'd love to hear the rest of you on this because I think you know more about it. I think evangelicals were so hostile to Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's not only pro-Trump. I think it was incredible suspicion and of Clinton. So if someone else had been running against him, I think it might have been a different story. But so this is kind of a perfect storm of factors. She's also the first woman presidential candidate. I think there was a lot of, you know, hidden anxiety about that, especially among evangelicals who have this understanding of headship, you know, that women are supposed to be subordinate to men's authority. But even with all that, I do think that there were evangelical ministers who were very busy trying to turn Trump into some kind of figure who could be understood through all these stories of biblical figures who sinned and yet God chose them anyway.
I was just getting started.
I know it. And I want to, there are other people waiting to get in.
I'm happy to talk later.
Be sure to sit together at lunch. Let me just quickly mention that every 4 years the Pew Research Center does a survey and asks Americans, you know, do you want your president to be a person of faith? And every 4 years it's at least 75% to 80% of Americans say they want to be a person of faith. Even with the rise of the nuns, that's happening. So I just wanted to throw that data point in there. AB, you're up next. Please pull the microphone up. And then EJ is after her. And
thank you so much. It's really been incredibly fascinating. I want to go back, since I'm the 25th questioner, my question overlaps with everyone else's, but picking up on what Will was talking about hours ago about the covenant and the burden of the blessing, where do you see the arc of that compact going in our history? How much of the bearing one's burdens, making others' conditions our own, remains tied to our chosenness? And I don't think today, people have touched on sort of the politics of today, I don't think it's solely the commitment of the religious, non-secular left to take care of their neighbor as thyself and be called to servitude. I don't think that's a fair assessment. But where has the covenant gone in the commitment to exceptionalism and belief in chosenness? There's always been a carve out for the other. So it was Native Americans, Indians, African Americans, women. It was that we'll take care of people like ourselves. But we have a debate raging in this country about others. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested in your thoughts about, like I said, I don't think it's just liberal religious Americans who believe we need to take care of others. So I'm just interested in, because you study this, where what's happened to the covenant and if it's gone with the Puritans.
So I would say that there is a debate in this country about how to take care of others. So I think there are different political strategies for taking care of others. So, you know, we could go back to George Bush and his compassionate conservatism and 1,000 points of light. I mean, I think he genuinely wanted to help others, but he thought that was the way to do it. I think this kind of covenant language is alive and well, and you hear it in surprising places. I was so touched by the woman who stood up at forget whose town meeting it was, what representative, but there was a woman who stood up to talk about healthcare, and she said, you know, the way that healthcare has worked is that the well pay for the sick. The well lift up the sick. We have a responsibility to others. And to me, this is, you know, you could trace this all the way back to John Winthrop. I have no idea what political party she belonged to, but it seemed to me that she was talking about a sort of covenant obligation. You know, who are we as a people and how do we care for one another? So I think that idea is still there, and that's why I want to, you know, say that individualism hasn't completely eclipsed a kind of sense of the common good. I do think that, you know, when we look at our political parties, that Republicans and Democrats argue about the best way to help others and what that means. But I will take seriously that both parties want to help others.
But it's no longer, I'm getting at whether or not it's been severed from the concept of our exceptionalism and our chosenness, because we could easily argue that the parties are differing over how to take care of each other. We could actually make the point that many who are America first are also now wanting to take care of people through this healthcare debate in ways they would never have admitted to or even thought they would admit to or imagine 4 years ago. But in terms of our identity, and as exceptional, is the covenant part separate from our identity as a nation? Out of many, one, we have to always bear each other's burdens. Is that sort of broken away?
Mm-hmm. It's a really provocative question. It's possible that some of that has been broken. I guess I'm an optimist, and I do still see that it's there. I mean, I even hear it in the language of, you know, what is it that makes America great? You know, there's something about the American identity, what America is supposed to be, that lies behind these arguments. But I suppose, you know, we'll come back to this room in 10 years and see what we think about whether this language has survived or whether, you know, to go back to Karen's point, which I think is really interesting, if almost the surfacing of it and the self-consciousness about it means that it's just going to be used more and more in a kind of expedient way in which you're never sure whether someone actually believes in it or not.
Yes. By the way, I just wanted to mention on your point about evangelicals having an anti-Hillary vote more than a pro-Trump vote, a well-known Southern Baptist leader who remained nameless said to me after the election, out of the 16 candidates, Michael, Donald Trump was my 17th choice. I do not want Hillary Clinton to win the election.
Yeah.
And I think that, I know a lot of people that were that way. They just could not, did not like Trump, but really didn't like her more. So anyway, I just thought to throw that anecdote in there, and only privately will I tell you who said that, but not on the record.
Well, as somebody, maybe he said it to you also. This will sound extreme, I know, but I do teach about Salem witchcraft and the witchcraft trials, and I've read all these transcripts, and my students go through it, and some of the language that was used about Hillary Clinton was really reminiscent. Oh, no, seriously. It really was. I mean, she was exerting magical powers by the time.
Well, you remember James Dobson coming out and doing all that justifying just based on how Hillary would ruin the world. So
we had our last faith thing, and we had a session with Bill Galston and Carlin Bowman on this very subject. So you can go to the transcript and the audio and the video for that if you'd like to watch. Okay, EJ, you're up. Pull the microphone up. EJ and Ann and Jordana, and we'll be done.
Just on this last point, I think the most revealing exit poll finding may be that 18% of Americans had an unfavorable view of both Clinton and Trump, and they voted for Trump 47-30. And they were the people who decided the election, not the people who loved Trump. Two quick things. One, Kate Bowler has helped us all by posting on the mammoth cheese on Twitter, which was delivered to Thomas Jefferson
John
by the
Leland.
Elder John Leland.
John Leland, yes.
From Massachusetts.
Oh, John
and the
thank
cheese
you.
Was made from the milk of 900 cows. So thank you. second, I hope this encourages you on your book, because I think all of us have been really taken by everything you've said. You had an answer for everything, which made me think of that phrase, a well-stocked mind. So thank you so much. I wanted to ask you about something that I think has not come up. I'm very curious about the Christian socialists and the social gospelers and their attitude toward this idea. Did they embrace it? Did they reject it? And is there anything revealing about that for us now?
Yeah. Yes. So thank you. Social gospel thinkers, people like Walter Rauschenbusch, certainly embraced this idea. Some of them were, you know, also involved in kind of missionary movements abroad, as well as charitable endeavors at home. And they had a very strong sense that the kind of essence of Christianity was social justice, and that that this was something that was tied up with American identity. So they did this sort of doubleness that you can see in somebody like King or Phyllis Wheatley, where on one hand they criticized the nation for not living up to its ideals, but also used the nation's ideals to argue that Americans had to do better, that they had to work harder to uplift the poor and to dedicate themselves to lives of Christian service. So this kind of language, yes, is certainly in the social gospel movement.
Thank you, Michael. Catherine, does American exceptionalism depend on religion? And with more Americans now identifying themselves as nuns, and a president who is clearly uncomfortable about speaking publicly about his faith or whatever his faith life may be, do you think it's in danger? And then my second question is, you spoke about this moment that we are in where fewer Americans identify themselves with organized religion and more of us see ourselves as spiritual. Has the nation ever been in such a moment before, and what may history tell us about how this shakes out?
Interesting. Two questions. Does American exceptionalism depend on religion? I think it could survive without its Christian roots. I think it would be something different. A lot of you have asked about the covenant and the sense of obligation and responsibility. I think American exceptionalism as a slogan does not have that embedded in it, which is why it makes me somewhat nervous. I do think, though, that, you know, even if it gets increasingly severed from its Christian roots, its ideas are indebted to Christian narratives. Going back to the founding, where Americans imagine themselves as the Israelites fleeing the captivity of the British, I feel as if these narratives are really very deeply woven into our self-understandings. I mean, even if you pick up an American history textbook, there are resonances of this kind of language. So I'm not sure that even if American exceptionalism, you know, increasingly leaves behind Christianity, whether the Christian basis could ever be completely erased, because it seems to me that the roots are, in fact, Christian, I think Molly asked earlier about Judeo-Christian, and I'm not sure I answered that. We now say Judeo-Christian, but that's really an invention of the 1940s and beyond. People did not use that language in the 19th century at all. This language was an attempt to make America more inclusive at a time when Jews were moving into suburbs and becoming increasingly well off. And I think you could say the same thing right now about a phrase that maybe you don't hear as much in your world, but I hear in mine, Abrahamic religions, which is an attempt to bring Islam into the Judeo-Christian paradigm. Remind me of the second question. It was about spiritual but not religious.
The second question was, have we ever been at a moment like this in history, and what may history tell us about how this moment will evolve?
Right. So I'm not going to place money on this. However, Nathan Hatch, who was mentioned earlier, I think would argue that the period right after the American Revolution was a period in which a lot of people were unchurched. Deism was actually a pretty formidable movement in in the 1790s and the early 1800s. And the response to that was a group of revivalists who really tried to Christianize the nation. And some historians, for example, John Butler, who I worked with at Yale, have argued that America became more Christian after 1800 than it had been before, even in the Puritan era, that revivalists responded to the sense that America was somehow in crisis, that Christianity was waning, and they responded with this wave of organizing, of publishing, of media outreach. Huge numbers of Bibles were published and given out for free. So the question is whether there are some seeds of that now, where there are activists who are concerned about spiritual but not religious, who are building the architecture that maybe we can't see yet for more revival. I think there's a lot going on in the internet. There are a lot of evangelicals in particular who are trying to use the internet to bring people back into a more traditional religious understanding. So I don't think that this is really unprecedented in American history. I think there have been times where religious allegiances have waxed and waned. The question is whether we're now at a tipping point where there are so many people who are skeptical about the church, that we're really looking at the birth of a more secular America, or whether the spiritual but not religious people are going to reinvent religion in a new way.
Only one more question, and we're running into lunch, but so, Jordana, if you could make a very concise, pointed question,
sure.
We will have a concise answer also.
So you've described an American nationalism that is a Christian articulation of exceptionalism and chosenness, and you know, Trump is giving voice or amplifying a nationalism that is uncoupled from religion, and I wonder if you do see it as uncoupled from religion, and if not, then what is the kind of tracing the Christian explanation for some of these ideas of isolationism and protectionism?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So right now for Trump, I think it is uncoupled from religion, but he is very unpredictable. You saw the slide of Paula White, who at his inauguration was, I think, trying to give him that sort of language. So what will happen there, I'm not sure. But I do see parallels between some of the unsavory people who are attracted to his language, yeah, and the movements in the past, like the Klan, or in our contemporary period, the Christian Identity Movement, which is a white nationalist movement, that they also see America as chosen, but for them, chosenness means whiteness, and it does mean isolationism. So I'm not sure where he himself will go with this, but I think it's possible his followers will take it in places that maybe he didn't intend or couldn't imagine. And it could go towards a kind of resurgence of, you know, what we saw on this slide earlier with thousands of people becoming members of the Ku Klux Klan. I think the Klan has been discredited now, but I think there are other sort of cognate kinds of organizations today that that have that same impulse, that America somehow is threatened. And when they're trying to figure out what America is threatened by, they're pointing toward Mexicans, Muslims, immigrants.
Sally, why don't you ask her at lunch?
Oh, that's, historians don't answer questions like that. I never say whether something is good or bad. I will give you a long answer about the ways in which it's good and the way in which it's bad. I do think, definitely not. I do think that the covenant, I will say this, I think that the covenant language doesn't always act as a check on this sort of the worst features of American exceptionalism, but it can. And I prize the way that it does.
Well, you can tell a session has been very good, a very great success when it runs right in and past lunch, beginning of lunch. And so join me in thanking our wonderful presenter. I'll just say that lunch is right out here where we had breakfast. Please eat and be prompt back here at 1 because we're going to have another great session.